This is the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media. Now, here's Jason Jones.
Aloha, everybody, and welcome to the Jason Jones Show. I am your host, Jason Jones, broadcasting from the beautiful hill country of Texas. All right, first of all, I'm going to do a few shows this week, I hope, if things don't get too crazy. I will be leaving for Ukraine in a couple of days. I will be traveling most of June, and in many places I will be traveling to. It may not be easy for me to record a podcast and or upload the podcast, but the first leg of my travels this summer will be to Ukraine. I'm going to Poland, and then from Poland I will be finding my way to Kyiv, where I will be attending a conference celebrating the incomparable beauty and dignity of the human person. And what a grace is it, really? What a grace is it to be able to go to Kyiv, a city that's under relentless missile attacks, and stand there with the people of Ukraine and talk about the incomparable beauty of the human person from the moment of our biological beginning through natural death, to talk about the importance of the family and the family's role and not only preserving and protecting the vulnerable in our families, like the child in the womb or like our elderly, but also the role of the family in creating a peaceful, orderly civil society. So I'm gonna have that opportunity in a couple of days, really just a week from today, I'll be there giving that talk. So I want to ask, first and foremost, that you pray for the event, you pray for everyone's safety, that they get there safely, that the event is safe, and that everyone gets home safely. And we pray that the message of this conference, it echoes around the world, that a conference in the heart of a country at war, the beating heart of a country at war, that message travels to every nook and cranny of the planet Earth. All right. So speaking of that, today we're going to be going back to Africa. We're going to be interviewing my good friend, Brad Phillips. He's going to give us another update on what's happening in Sudan. Just today, it's been reported that an orphanage of children has been found. The adults had been murdered and the children starved to death. This is really, really unbelievable. It is quite tragic. And I don't understand how in a world where there's a 24-hour news cycle that these stories make it on B17 in the newspapers and that these aren't the front shelf topics. Because God forbid the people of the world clamored for peace, peace in Sudan, peace in Ukraine. God forbid, because if people had this information, the world would be demanding a ceasefire in Sudan. This podcast exists for these stories to be told. That's why it exists. And so I'm grateful for you for being a regular listener to the show. The show, again, I said at the end of the interview, we cracked the top 100 again podcasts in America last week, which is exceptional for a show that I do hit or miss because I travel so much and it can be 20 minutes to 3.5 hours. And you listen, 80% of you finish every show. And I'm so grateful for that. And so many of you stand with us. I mentioned this a lot in the podcast. Brad is challenging us to a $100,000 matching grant, which will allow us to give 5,000 families shelter, food and shelter, and the care that they need. As if you Google Sudan right now, the first story you're going to see is the children starving to death in the orphanage, but you're going to hear about riots, you're going to hear about civil unrest, terrorist attacks, artillery shellings of neighborhoods. You're going to see all of that. But intentional direct violence is not the cause of most casualties. Most casualties in war are because you don't get the medicine you need, you don't have access to food or clean water, or you die of exposure. As if you're a regular listener to the show or a longtime supporter of the Vulnerable People Project, you know most of our work in Afghanistan gears up. It's to deliver coal so people don't die of exposure in the brutal winters. In fact, we are already right now at VPP preparing on how we can greatly expand our Coal for Christmas campaign next year to keep Christians other minorities alive, other vulnerable communities alive through the next brutal winter, because so many people lost their lives this past winter. Same thing in Sudan. It's not just these children who are starving to death. All across Sudan, people are dying from exposure. People are dying from starvation. People are dying because they don't have access to clean water. And of course, they're dying to violence. So we have this challenge. Go to thegreatcampaign.org, click on the Hope for Sudan link, which is the first thing you'll see, and you will help us meet that match. And Brad Phillips is the most knowledgeable. There's not one person, not one person at the U.S. State Department. There's not one person on the other side of the river from the State Department over there in Langley. There's not one person that you're going to meet that knows more about the Nuba Mountains. Sudan broadly, maybe you'll meet somebody here or there. You're never going to meet anyone who knows more about the Nuba Mountains than Brad Phillips. In fact, he's been living there and working there for over 20 years. He's practically Nuban. He's there. He's been there more since I have known him than he's been here. He comes here like 3 times a year to meet with me and other friends and donors. That's it. So you're not going to want to miss this interview. And so this episode is being, can you tell I'm a little off today. This episode is being brought to you by the Vulnerable People Project, standing in solidarity with the most vulnerable people in the world when the world is left. It is also being brought to you by Epoch Times. If you want to stay free, you have to be informed. And the best newspaper in the world, you know it, is Epoch Times. Side note, I've reached out to Epoch Times, and hopefully they're actually going to send a reporter with me to Ukraine. I may be traveling with someone from Epoch Times. I want to get Epoch to cover this conference, and they're eager to find a way to get someone to go with me to Kyiv to cover this conference. And that's what Epoch Times is. Epoch Times is the most important newspaper in the world, and you need to subscribe. So go to iReadEpoch.com, use the code Jason Jones, and your first month will be only $1. All right, my interview with my hero and yours, Brad Phillips, on the Jason Jones Show. Brad Phillips, Persecution Project Foundation. Welcome to the Jason Jones Show.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I know you are suffering from a really bad cold and a upper respiratory infection, as am I. So hopefully the folks will forgive our coughing and our raspy voices.
Yes.
But it's important we do the show. I know that you're in the States right now, traveling around meeting with folks. I'm heading overseas to Ukraine in a couple of days to speak at a conference in Kyiv. But I thought it was very important to do a show today because Sudan has completely fallen off the mainstream media's radar. Meanwhile, Christian neighborhoods are being targeted, and the war has escalated, and there are civilian casualties are overwhelming, and the world's looking away. So the Jason Jones Show is going to look because the world is looking away, and I thought we'd have you on to give us an update. So I'm not going to talk too much because I don't want to say too much, and you know where to draw the lines, and okay. I might slip and say something that we can't really share. But, by the way, every time you're on, I'm always worried that when we deal with these tough topics that are hard for folks to listen to, that we don't maintain our audience, but they're our biggest shows and people listen to the end. So you have Wonderful. Time to map things out for folks and explain to them what's happening.
Well, thank you, Jason. I'm grateful to be on the show. And I don't know what day this podcast will air, but we're 45 days. As of today, we're 45 days into the war that started on April 15th in Khartoum, and the body count keeps rising. And there are a number of different news sources out there that are tracking what's happening in Sudan, and it's very interesting. For some reason, they've decided to keep the body count very low. Personally, I think if you doubled or tripled the numbers and added to zero, you might be coming closer to the reality on the ground. Of course, it's very hard it's very hard from outside to really get a handle on statistics, but the amount of ordnance that's being thrown in Sudan is massive, and both sides are spending millions and millions of dollars a day on the war. Both sides are continuing to heavily recruit, even as talks have been underway there in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia for the last more than a week.
Now, what are you doing? What is the Persecution Project Foundation doing in partnering with us? Can you lay out for folks what we've been able to do together and what your people on the ground are doing?
Yeah, there's a lot we can talk about, and there are some details that we don't need to talk about. But as you know, and as we've shared with your listeners, we have a long-term relationship with Sudan, and especially with a certain region in Sudan known as Southern Kordofan or the Nuba Mountains. And that relationship goes back about 26 years. And everything that we're doing as an organization is built on the foundation of that relationship, where we've just invested a lot of time and a lot of our resource and our heart in trying to stand alongside the Nuba community. And the Nuba community is noteworthy in Sudan because they're one of the two indigenous groups in Sudan, one of the two largest indigenous groups, the other being the Nubians. And we estimate that there's about 6 million ethnic Nubians who live in Sudan, and about half of that Nuba population has been directly affected by this fighting, and the other half are indirectly affected because all of their relatives are there in those conflict areas. And so to your question, what are we doing? We've already been involved in trying to stand with that community because they were the number one target of persecution and genocide historically in Sudan for the last 35 years has been the Nuba people, primarily because of their identification with the Christian faith. They've been the target of some of the worst persecution and genocide. And there's a region in Sudan, it's become sort of an enclave outside of the domain of Sharia law, where the Nuba community are from and where many of them are residing, which is known as the Nuba Mountains. It's known as Southern Kordofan. And that area is about the size of the state of Georgia or the size of Rwanda and Burundi in geographic size. And up until recently, they were the target of all kinds of military assault in a war that still hasn't officially ended. But as of April, fighting has shifted to Khartoum between two factions within the government. For those who heard previous podcasts, I may be repeating some things, but that fighting that's taken place, it started in the capital and has spread to all of the other states in Sudan, has resulted in millions of people being uprooted from their homes. So the Nuba community, which was once the target of the worst persecution, has now become a safe haven and a refuge for people fleeing from other parts of Sudan. So right now, especially in the last 45 days, we've been doing everything we can to stand with them and continue to be a resource to them so that they can receive their relatives and members of their community who are coming back. So that means medical services, access to safe water, shelter services. And without going into too much detail, I can say that the VPP has been standing with us in some of our efforts to discreetly help members of that community who are trapped in the city find their way out. And we've had a lot of success in the last couple of weeks in getting some people out. Many people are finding their way out on their own. But there are really hundreds of thousands of people who just don't have the resource to get out of the city. And they're stuck in the crossfire. Literally, their neighborhoods are being bombed. Their houses are the subject of house-to-house attacks by the RSF or sometimes by the SAF, where they're going in and they're abusing people, they're raping people, they're abducting people, they're killing people, they're destroying property. So this is the fate of the people that don't manage to escape the city. And for those who are trying to get out, the journey out is a difficult one, and they have to pass through all kinds of checkpoints. There are parts of the road that are controlled by one side and parts by the other. The RSF controls many, many checkpoints. The SAF controls many checkpoints. Both sides are looking, especially for young men. The young men are being pulled off of buses, and sometimes they're just summarily executed. Other times they're being taken away to prisons. Other times of being forcibly conscripted into one side or the other. So those are some of the situations on our side. To your question, we're trying to provide basic shelter items like tarps is one of the things that is needed. The rain started in April, and now as we're approaching June and starting into June, as it gets heavier and heavier into the rainy season, simple things like shelter make the difference between life or death. You know, after you've escaped the bullet, now you're facing, just the extreme conditions of not having shelter in the middle of the rain. So,
and Brad, I think it's important for a lot of folks, like when you're listening, I know a lot of people will say, Jason, I want to donate to a rescue. I want to donate for an evacuation. Yeah. And that's very important. But at the end of the day, and there are countless people who are being murdered, beaten.
Yeah.
I've seen the video of people having their heads smashed in with rocks, with bricks, shot, artillery, mortar rounds. But when this is all said and done, like in every war, most of the deaths are going to come from exposure, from starvation, from drinking bad water, and from not having access to very basic health care like antibiotics and insulin.
That's exactly right. And so we were already facing these kind of problems with the Nuba community because in the last 4 years, we've had 1 million people come back to the Nuba Mountains in just the last 4 years because of violence at a lower level that was happening in Khartoum, because of targeting and persecution of believers and of people based on their faith, but also based on their ethnicity. And so just between 2019 and April of 2023, the population went from 1.7 million to 2.7 million. In the last 45 days, we've seen an extra 150 to 200,000 people who have shown up. And the numbers of returnees is doubling about every 10 days. And so when those people come back, and all those other people who came back in the months before that, basic things make the difference between life and death. So in the medical area, we have been involved in providing essential drugs to the medical consortium that the Secretary of Health, which manages 200 medical facilities in the Nuba Mountains. But what we provide was based on a population of 1 million people. Now we have 3 million people, and it's going to 4 million people. So we've been trying our best to step up our efforts and increase the amount of medicines that we can supply. We manage several hospitals there. One of the newest hospital that we built in 2015 is the second biggest hospital in the Nuba Mountains and sees about 3,000 patients a month. And those numbers are just going to go up as people return. And then basic things like water. But right now, I think the biggest need we have, the number one need for just emergency crisis situation for people who have made it out is shelter. A simple thing like a $40 tarp, which seems like insignificant to us, is so essential there because people come back and they have to make temporary housing. And I know you've seen a lot of the pictures, Jason. I'll try to paint the picture with words. They build houses out of grass. If they don't have a tarp, then the water gets in and they're getting sick all kinds of different ways as a result of that. So a simple thing like a $40 tarp can keep some of the weather out for a family of five or six people. And so we have a shelter tarp program, and that's something right now where we just need more and more. If I could, there's a more than 15,000 families who've shown up in just the last 45 days. And, if we could provide shelter for half of those families, it would make a huge difference. And so we're trying to do that. And VPP has really been a champion in standing with Persecution Project in meeting the needs there in Sudan, and specifically in responding to this crisis. And I will say, on the evacuation side, as I say, we are, you know, our heart is for the least of these. And, you know, in the case of the Nuba Mountains, they're one of the most marginalized communities in Sudan. And they're one of the biggest victims of this war that's happening in Khartoum. And as I say, historically, they have been the number one target and probably public enemy number one of the Islamic State in Sudan. And right now they're getting hammered again because of this war. So we've been doing our best to try to work alongside the community there in the Nuba Mountains and with the network that they have, trying to assist them in different ways, whether it's by bringing relief to people trapped in the city or trying to help them find their way out. And that's a window that may close at any time, but we're going to continue to do, you know, whatever we can as God allows.
You know, one of the points that you keep making, and you know, for those who you don't work or run nonprofits, reporting what you do with donor money is very important. And oftentimes people say, how many people did you feed or how many people did you shelter? But the reality is that's not how it works. You don't shelter individuals. You don't feed individuals. Yeah. You care for families. Right. And when you provide a tarp, under that tarp is going to be mom, dad, aunts, uncles, grandma, baby. Yeah. And they're all going to be there together. And you're saving a family. You're saving generations. You have generations together. Can you tell people about the Nuba, what makes them so unique in Sudan and really in the world as a people?
Yeah, I think before I do that, I think just this issue of families versus individuals, you know, that's, I think, central to the Nuba identity and their culture is a strong family. They really do have a very strong culture and strong families. And the family, you know, we you know, growing up in America, they used to talk about the nuclear family. But in Africa and in Sudan and in the Nuba Mountains, you don't really have the nuclear family. The family is really the whole extended family. So, you know, if I give you a figure of six people, we're really, really understating what makes up a family. You know, when the UN or other groups are giving statistics, they talk about households, and I don't like to use that term. We like to say family. So, but for sure, you know, the Nuba they're unique in many ways, and they're distinct. Sudan has so many different ethnicities, so many different cultures, and you know, diversity. And one of the things about the Nuba that they're very proud of is that they have an incredibly tolerant culture. You find many, many different tribes in the Nuba Mountains, and you find people of diversity of faith and culture that are living with each other peacefully. And they're very proud of that. What you also find is that, you know, and what I've just come to believe is that mountain people just are better. You know, wherever you go, not just in Sudan, but certainly in the case of the Nuba Mountains, they're mountain people, and they're very, which means they're very resilient. They're very hardy. They don't want a handout. They just want to be able to farm. They want they're hardworking people. So even the founder of the Nuba nationalist movement, one of the sort of the George Washington of the Nuba Mountains, was a guy named Yosef Kouameki. And I had the privilege to meet him back in 1998 on my first visit to the Nuba Mountains. And he died, I think, in 2000, it was either 2001 or 2002 of cancer. But he refused all kinds of opportunity for food to be delivered to the Nuba Mountains. He said, please, whatever you do, don't send in, we don't want aid. We've seen how aid has destroyed so many cultures and countries around the world. We've seen how it's been so destructive in certain parts of, you know, neighboring South Sudan. If you want to help us, give us tools, give us seed. We know how to plant. If you want to help us, you know, just allow us to defend ourselves. and allow us to work, and we'll be okay. And stop funding, you know, the people that are bombing us. You know, those are his messages. Don't help our enemies. Leave us alone. If you want to help us, give us some seeds, give us some tools. We know how to work. So that kind of is epitomizes what the Nuba people are like. They're very, as they say, they're hardworking people, they're resilient people, and they're also, you know, a people of faith. And in the context of the church in Sudan, the church in Sudan starts with the Nuba Mountains. Because whatever happened centuries ago, you know, you can talk about the Ethiopian eunuch converted by the Apostle Philip, and you can trace some connection to Nubia and Nuba back to that church. But those churches were wiped out by waves of Islamic invasions and sort of disappeared. But at the beginning of the 20th century, around 1917, you had missionaries come back, and somewhere between 1917 and 1922, you began to see conversions taking place. And now, about 100 years later, you have more than 3 million Nuba who identify as Christian. And apart from some small pockets of, you know, Coptic Christians left over from the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, those communities, and apart from the South Sudanese Christian community in Sudan, majority, more than 90%, of Christians in Sudan are ethnic Nubians. And that's why I believe the Islamofascist regime in Khartoum has put so much time and energy in trying to wipe them out.
Yeah, the Muslim communities are an offense to the extremists because they can't be radicalized.
Right.
And they're just as much in danger or in more danger than the rest of the communities as well.
Many different shades and stripes of Islam in Sudan, and for sure the elites that dominate, they call them the Northern Nile River Arabs, the ones that dominate the former National Congress Party, which is now known as the military, which are the ones that are the officers in the Sudan Armed Forces. They represent, you know, an ethnic, religious, and political minority in Sudan. And so most of the Sudanese Muslims don't identify, you know, with the Ingaz of the National Islamic Front. But it's a totalitarian system. So the Muslims who are not lockstep Islamofascist Muslim Brotherhood type adherents are persecuted as apostate, and the non-Muslims are persecuted as infidels. And that's sort of how the regime has used their brand of Islamism as a whip in the fascist system that they have there.
What do you see happening in the coming weeks? What are going to be the needs on the ground in the coming weeks?
Yeah, I mean, right now, as I say, the biggest need is shelter. I mean, they need everything. They need food. They need water. They need medicine. The goodness is about the Nuba Mountains is they have a relatively safe space if they can reach to the Nuba Mountains. Many people are fleeing out of Sudan. People that are going out to Chad, you know, they're stuck and they're destitute there, and they're relying on donors there. People that are getting to Egypt, the same people are fleeing to South Sudan, the same. Internally, inside of Sudan, the best place for people to go right now is in southern Kordofan in the Nuba Mountains. And so the goodness is that relative to the other states in Sudan, it has the least amount of military conflict there and the most amount of space. But it's the rainy season, and the rainy season is a 5 or 6 month event every year, and during that time many things become difficult. Travel becomes difficult, roads become rivers, and malaria goes up, you know, because mosquitoes breed in pools of water. Waterborne diseases go up because people start drinking water out of pools collecting on the ground if they don't have access to safe water wells. So medical needs go up. But one of the core things that can mitigate a lot of those environmental challenges is just something basic like shelter. So having shelter really reduces a lot of the impact of the rainy season. And for the communities that are receiving this big influx of returnees, we're just trying to stand with them and provide some basic assistance. You know, nothing that we're doing is going to sustain anybody forever. You know, anybody who tells you you're going to help somebody for the rest of their life with a $40 tarp is lying to you. But it serves multiple purposes. One is it does have a physical impact. It does physically protect people. Two is that it sends a message of encouragement and solidarity and hope. As you know from your work all over the world, Jason, is that in these kind of situations where people are the target of persecution and suffering from war and all kinds of things like that, they're surviving on vapors of hope, on vapors of encouragement. So just the knowledge that a family on the other side of the world is praying for them and has invested something to help save their life is fuel that sustains them and propels them forward.
You know, that is why I founded VPP. You know, the work that you do, Brad, is thick. It's deep. It has roots. You work in one place year in and year out. Good times, you know, there have been a lot of good times since you started working in Sudan. A lot of it because of your work. Bad times. And the Vulnerable People Project exists to serve those groups and that serve those communities in really, really bad times. Unfortunately, in Afghanistan, everyone left. So we started, you know, working with groups that were there, that had been there for 20 years, getting a lot of federal funds, trillions of dollars slushing around. And tragically, they all have gone and we're the only group left. And so now we're putting roots in Afghanistan. We've been there now 2 years and we're putting in these deep roots. But you have very deep roots serving these vulnerable communities. And at the end of the day, you know, me and our group of friends and my son was with us in Washington, D.C. when we were meeting with influencers. And I was teasing you to our friends about how Brad never smiles. You know, Brad, you got 1,000 people out today. And, you know, you look at your feet and you shake your head and you make a sad laugh and walk away. But that is the result of knowing sometimes you feel like no matter what we do, so what, right? But the key is you give 15,000 families tarps. Brad Phillips knows that there's going to be another 30,000 families that are suffering outside of they're suffering exposure. But what's the difference? Why do we do it? Well, because it gives everyone hope. Everyone gets hope. It'll probably be impossible to give every family shelter, everyone the insulin they need, everyone the antibiotics they need, everyone the clean water they need. But we can save hundreds of thousands of people while giving a nation's hope. And at the same time, which I know is at the core of the work that you do, you're sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ in a very meaningful way through loving people through their hardest times. And not only loving them from a distance, but standing with them shoulder to shoulder, struggling with them, suffering with them, risking with them. And this is why we do what we do. And it also changes at home. You and I were having a conversation just as friends right before this show about how America, we are a great nation. We are a beautiful people. But something has happened, like the hospitality that we're used to is vanishing. The mutual respect we have from people of different faiths or different cultures seems to be dissolving all around us. And you said it's because we've lost a belief in human dignity. And so through the work that you're doing, we're not only giving people across Sudan and South Sudan hope, but we're hopefully educating our nation on human dignity and its demands that it places on us to care for those around us.
I think you've said a lot, and that rings true. I think dignity is definitely at the core of what we want to do as well, and the dignity of the human person is at the core of it. So often I hear people ask, people despair of these situations because there's so much bad news in the news. And Africa has always been in the bad news part of the news. And so you have a lot of folks who just despair and they say, well, you know, what's the point? You know, why? What, you know, why? Why should we? Why should we, you know, invest in a place like this? I've got trouble at home, et cetera. And I think it definitely at the core of it is your belief that we're made in God's image, you know, and that is the basis of human dignity, is the dignity that is ascribed to us by our Creator who made us. So, but let me get to your other question. What's happening next? What do I see is happening down the road? You know, when we started this current war in the Nuba, not the one that started in Khartoum in April, but the one that started in 2011, there are many similarities in the behavior of the regime in that war as what we're seeing in Khartoum. And the first thing that they did was they tried to turn the lights out on the flow of information. And the way they did that was they expelled all of the humanitarian groups, all of the NGOs that were working in the Nuba Mountains were expelled in April of 2011, you know, 2 months before they launched a full-scale assault on the civilian population. And our organization was one of, you know, less than a half a dozen groups that decided to stay in defiance of that ban of NGOs, and that enabled us to have a front seat and be an eyewitness to what was happening from the beginning. We're seeing the same thing happening in Khartoum. There's these negotiations that have been going on in Saudi Arabia for the last couple of weeks. And a lot of that is to try to justify the flow of money to both sides in this conflict through, you know, under the guise of humanitarian support. They're trying to negotiate different ceasefires, and there's a lot of money that's flowing in areas that are controlled by either side. But even as they're negotiating deals on paper, on the ground, the negotiations are not holding. And the word is getting out that both sides are still spending a lot of money procuring more armaments, more ordnance, and recruiting more troops. So we really expect that, like, the fighting has, in the last couple of days, has died down a little bit, but peace talks broke off today. Both sides started accusing the other side again. But throughout this whole thing, they both have been spending a lot of money on this war every day, millions and millions of dollars a day, both sides. So we really are expecting that it's going to get worse on the ground. And from the groups that are monitoring the conflict on the ground, what is unique and different about this war is just the fact that most of the fighting is happening in the cities, which are, you know, in civilian residential areas. And so at least half of the people who are dying from artillery, from shelling, from bombing, from shooting, and other types of action are civilians. And so that is going to feed into more and more people fleeing in different directions. So that's a long way of saying it's getting worse.
You know, it gets to be a little disheartening when you see the peace talks break down. We see the same thing in Ukraine. You know, where are the adults in the room? I have to imagine that if the Gulf states and the United States, Egypt, really wanted this to end, am I naive in thinking it would end?
I don't know if you're naive, but I think that I think there's two things going on. I think the people involved in the peace talks have different motives. You know, the two armed parties to the conflict are engaging in the peace talks for political cover. But meanwhile, they're being pretty open about the fact that they have no intention of backing down until the other side is completely wiped out. So, I mean, I think whether it's Burhan or Hameti, they both want to be seen as respecters of human rights, even as they, you know, ramp up their abuse and their abusive behavior. And so, you know, this is like a political cover for them. I think the Saudis and the United States and others, you know, they have their own political agenda. And on the U.S. side, I'm sure they want to be seen as a broker of peace and a supporter of human rights. And they have an agenda to figure out a way for, you know, humanitarian aid to flow and to get some humanitarian corridors open up. So even the peace talks that are underway are not about ending the conflict. They're just about humanitarian corridors. And but they're not, none of them have really been respected. None of the they've agreed on paper to many ceasefires from the beginning up to now, and none of them have been respected for even 1 hour. There's been different levels of intensity in fighting, but you know, for sure, the people who are invested in the war are doubling down, and there are many, many, many countries who are invested on both sides in this power struggle. So,
once they decided to smash order, you know, you're going to have protests, riots, terrorism, thug and gang violence, criminal activities. You're going to run amok.
Not to mention
the battles, right? The battles are the one thing, but the breakdown of order is a total, it's another thing.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, the way Sudan is set up within the regime, there are many, many different factions and militias already. And then within the different coalitions that were negotiating with the military, there are all of these OAGs, other armed groups, you know, militias as well. So there are all kinds of different armed factions. And then there are just like criminal elements, as you say. All of the prisons were attacked and all the prisoners were released in the capital. And so different bands have formed. So there's a lot of raping, looting, killing, and thuggery that's going on in the city, apart from what's being done by the two sides. But for sure, on the side of the RSF, for example, you know, they're spending they're cashing in a lot of gold to buy weapons and troops. And so there are, you know, militants coming from all over the region who are being paid in cash to come and fight with the RSF. On the SAF side, they're spending a lot of money recruiting and calling up reservists and spending a lot of money on arms as well and ordnance. And so both sides are spending a huge amount of coin to take the other side out. And they both think they can win, and they're both, you know, trying to project that they're winning on the ground. And but some of the groups that are monitoring it, it looks like it's a pretty closely matched war that's unfolding.
And meanwhile, for those of you, Brad, you asked when this drops. This will drop today, soon, within minutes of us recording this interview. And so if you Google right now, what's the story in the news? 60 children die trapped in Khartoum orphanage amid conflict. Infants, toddlers, and older children died from fever or lack of food while trapped in deteriorating conditions.
Yeah, those are the stories. They're coming out every day, stories like that. There's very, very little good news coming out. And it's horrific. It's a horrific situation. And we're getting people coming back to our area. Some that we've assisted in their escape and others who've made it on their own. And they're all coming out with stories of equal level of horror. We have lots of people related to us who have been the victim of the war. You know, some have been targeted and killed. Others have just been, you know, caught in the crossfire. Some people have died inside of their homes. We had one family, and their neighbor, the artillery shell landed on the house of their neighbor. That was another Nupa family, and the entire family was killed in a blink of an eye. So it's, when you think of the medical services, where the hospitals have all basically been shut down, and both sides are going around and abusing medical staff because for several reasons. One is they accuse the doctors of being part of the doctors' trade union that was part of the street resistance committees. So if you're a doctor, you're automatically, considered to be an enemy of the RSF and an enemy of the SAF. So many doctors are being murdered. There's been stories in the paper every day of different famous doctors who were murdered. There was a guy who was kidnapped. It was in the paper the other day. And so this is a regime, and these are people who the other thing that they're doing is they're saying they're going where they do know that there are clinics operating. If they find out that they're treating combatants from either side, they're killing people. The SAF or Burhan has told all the hospitals in their area, like El Obeid and North Kordofan, is controlled by the SAF, and they have gone in and shut down hospitals and killed staff because they were accused of treating RSF wounded. And so this is just the level of barbarity unfolding.
So, Brad, your organization and one of your donors stepped up and challenged the Vulnerable People Project, and it's a big challenge. Both of us run, relatively small organizations compared to these groups that people think of, like the Red Cross and the Red Crescent that are out there. First of all, I want to ask you, are the large organizations on the ground in Khartoum? Do you see them in the Nuba Mountains? You said there were only six groups that decided to stay.
Yeah, you know what? I can't really speak to Khartoum. I don't know. I just know what I see in the newspaper and what I hear through the grapevine. I don't really know what's happening. I know in the Nuba Mountains, apart from, a small handful that we know, like Samaritan's Purse, which is a wonderful organization, has done tremendous things in Sudan for decades and decades. And in the Nuba Mountains, they've been real champions there. They continue to do wonderful work, saving a lot of lives. I haven't seen people coming back to the Nuba Mountains, and all of the official groups that were registered with Khartoum that were expelled in 2011 have stayed out. They haven't come back. Because those groups, in the UN and the World Health Organization, for example, they rely on the permission of the regime to do whatever they're doing. So even though the regime might be the one committing the crimes, they'll want to get permission first before they go in and serve in those areas. So they haven't come back yet.
And it's not we're not slapping these organizations. We need large organizations to cooperate with these regimes. So they're playing their role, and so they step up when they're asked
Within the constraints of how they're set up.
Yeah,
they haven't been able to come back. I know the World Health Organization has been threatening to come back, and they did do some things in Nuba in the last 2 years, but they've been restricted by the regime in really coming back. So I guess the short answer for now is that we're not yet.
It's very lonely. And this was my point. Like, if I'm an individual donor, I want to work with groups like BPP and PPF. Maybe if I'm Facebook or Google or whatever, I'm going to give to these large organizations. But I want to be there when I don't need the regime's permission to be there. I want to serve people when I don't need to ask for permission. I want to be there where it's hardest to reach in those times that it's most challenging. And that's what you're doing. And then you challenged us. You said, Jason, let's do 5,000 families right now, 100,000 matching grants. So at our website,
By the way, way I can do that is if you guys can step up to the challenge. I mean, it's going to be a stretch for us, but so that's why we put it out there. And, $40 is basically represents the cost of providing shelter for one family. And so you know, to help 5,000 families, that's $200,000. So
if everyone listening donated, Brad, if everyone listening to the show donated $40, we would meet the match. That's $100,000. If everyone listening went to thegreatcampaign.org and made a donation, and you'll see Hope for Sudan, the very first thing you'll see, we would meet the match. And there's, we need people to step up. There has been no reserve fund since Afghanistan collapsed. We fight every month for every safe house that we support, all the widows and orphans that we support, all the Catholic parishes that we support in Nigeria. It's a fist fight every month to keep our commitments, which we always keep. And then now we have this catastrophe in Sudan, and the Persecution Project Foundation. I have a relationship with you guys going back over 2 decades, and you are the one organization that I most respect, and I've even modeled how we operate on. So I trust you, and we want to be there with you. So I'm asking everyone, if you have never donated, I have friends that listen to the show, and I see you donate every time I ask. You don't have to donate every time I ask, but if you've never donated or you feel called to donate right now, if everyone listening did $40, we would meet the match. If 1,000 people listened and did $1,000, we'd meet the match. It's a big ask. I understand. Yeah. And the world is on fire, and we're being drawn. Those of us who are Christians and or committed to the common good, we're being drawn and quartered in every direction, from our families to our neighborhoods to our communities to our alma maters to the world is on fire. But this is truly, these people are the most vulnerable people on earth. They're begging God for help. They're watching as their children are sick. They're watching as their children don't have clean water. They're watching as their grandmother doesn't have insulin. And we really, it's not impossible. It is not hopeless. It is not, we are not helpless. They are helpless. If we stand with them, no one's helpless. Yeah. And those nuns, can we talk, the nuns that, Brad, that you and your organization stepped up and evacuated for the Vulnerable People Project, they would probably be dead today. I don't think that's an exaggeration, because their neighborhood was devastated days after we took, if we took them out. And if
you know, Jason, I think it's okay, you know, to, our concern always is that we, is not to provide too many details that can put somebody in harm's way. But when you told us about these three sisters, you know, the first thing was trying to figure out where they were, and then the problem in Khartoum is that there's no phone network. So even people that have a phone, you can't call them. So you basically have to physically show up at their house and find them. And so we had some people that went and saw them, and the first challenge was that they're scared, like everybody. And we've talked about this before. I mean, when you're in this level of crisis in your life, people respond in different ways. Some people, just go into the combat mode, and they figure out a way how to, find their way out of a situation and do whatever it takes to get out of a situation. And they, even climb over other people to do it. And there's other people, that will just shut down, and they will be paralyzed with fear. And, where I made the analogy to you of the Titanic, I guess there are some people on Titanic who got onto the lifeboat, and there are other people that refused to move out of their room and just went down with the ship. So these dear sisters, are elderly and frail and suffering with different kind of physical ailments. And I think they didn't really know what to do. And so even though they had a chance to get out, it took a lot of days of conversation, just going back and visiting, to try to convince them, hey, you really need to leave, and there's a way that we can get you where you need to go. Not days, it took a couple of weeks, actually. But the interesting thing was, is that there were all kinds of people praying. Your people were praying. And God was also working in the circumstance, because the particular area where they were, which we don't need to mention, but, you know, was one of the places which was right in the middle of the soup. And, you know, fighting was happening in their neighborhood, in the neighborhoods around them. And they could hear the shelling. They could hear the shooting every day. And it was getting louder and louder and worse and worse. And so, you know, God used a number of different circumstances to change their mind. And they made the right decision. And, you know, somehow they made their, you know, they were able to get out. So we really, you know, we're really thankful for the outcome, and we're happy to have had a part in that.
And that happened because of a community of friends. A woman in St. Louis who supports this order knew a friend of mine. The friend of mine said, call Jason Jones, maybe he can help.
Yeah.
We've worked with you. You're my brother. You're my good friend. I reached out to you. Then we reached out to our donors on this podcast. Our donor stepped up. And the donor in St. Louis, the friend of the religious order, gave us a matching grant. And then together, our friendship goes back 2 decades. Your friendship in the Nuba Mountains goes back over 2 decades. This woman knew a friend of mine that was from over 2 decades. And then we're on this show. And then that all conspired to help rescue not just these sisters, but many, many, many other people. And this is how it works.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said, we without going into any details about how and where and what, there was certainly a good network of people that God provided us. And, you know, even we, you know, at the beginning of this war on the 15th of April, when it started, I was in Nairobi and I was sitting with my key coordinator for Sudan, and we were just vexed by the whole situation and just trying to figure out, you know, is there something that we can do for some of those people that are there in the city? Because this is, you know, this is not where we have been concentrating most of our efforts. And just in a couple of days, God provided somebody who reached out to us, somebody that we knew was related to somebody, you know, who knew somebody and who knew us, whatever. We started talking and it's been a journey. And what's amazing is the resilience of these people. And what's amazing is the courage of some of these people. We have some young people and some elderly people involved in this process who, again, I don't want to disclose them on this podcast, but they risked their life for the last 45 days. They made a decision not to regard their own life so that they could help other people.
They're the heroes.
So,
but they would have been helpless without you, without the donors, without every link in the chain is necessary. Everyone is a necessary condition for them, the lives to be saved.
Yeah.
That's
yeah. And
reality.
You know, I told you about one guy who was killed, you know, one of the people that was helping in this process. Cause again, you have to go, and literally pluck people out of their home. And, you know, there are certain neighborhoods where, you know, we have relationship to different communities there. And the only way to communicate with them is face to face. It's not over the phone. And to get there, you've got to walk through all kinds of hostile corridors where there's active fighting going on during different parts of the day. Sometimes you get to stop the work for hours while you're waiting for the fighting to stop. And then you can make a break and pass through some corridor to get to some neighborhood. And along the way, there are bodies in the street and they're rotting. So these guys that were doing the work took tremendous risks, and some of them died. Some were shot.
Yeah, And sadly, the longer this war goes on, the more aid workers will die, the more children will starve to death in orphanages, the more elderly will die because they don't have access.
Well, these aren't even aid workers. These are just you know, courageous believers who are just trying to you know, do the right thing in their within their own community, and sometimes for people outside of their own community, people that they don't know.
Well, and with the sisters, you know, which you said, and I want to just reemphasize, your team members that went there had to go there risking their life day after day to try to convince them to leave. And what I was so, why I am so grateful for these believers that work for you on the ground in Sudan is that it could have been so easy to just leave and say they didn't want to go. I'm not going back there. That was just too dangerous to begin with. They said they didn't want to go, but they took it upon themselves to say, no, they need to go. I'm going to go there tomorrow again. And then I'm going to go the day after again. And, you know, these are the types of beautiful people we work with. I see the same thing in Afghanistan with our volunteers, where they go. There have been times where I have had to say, I veto this operation. And then they will say, no, you don't tell us. If we don't rescue this girl, she's going to commit suicide. We have to do this. We see this in Ukraine with Ryan Hendrickson, tip of the spear landmine removal, our partner. I said, Ryan, I really appreciate that you move landmines, but do you have to remove them so fast? Because he does it like he's picking daisies, man. I'm like, slow down. You know, like you're a hero. We get it. Keep doing it. But I think you should move a little slower. He's like, I'm a professional. This is what I do. And okay. And it's your guys. They took it upon themselves. How easy would it have been for them to say, I went. They don't want to go. It's done.
Yeah.
It's like the gentleman who works for you when you first brought me to Sudan. We went to meet him, and he, you know, his motorcycle broke down, and he was supposed to go inspect wells. Well, if my motorcycle broke down, I'd have probably been like, yeah, my motorcycle broke down. I need to fix it. Then I'll go inspect the wells. This guy walked around Sudan borrowing kayaks and donkeys, and he did his job. These are the real heroes that no one ever is going to hear on a podcast, by the way. They're not going to do shows, or they're doing their job.
Yeah.
These are the real heroes, the unknown heroes that thoughtfully and quietly do the very most important work on earth.
Yeah. Well, that's what makes my work easy we have a really great team, and we have some courageous people that you want to help. It's easy. You know, it's easy to love good people. It's hard to love some kind of people are harder to love. But there's some really courageous people, and especially, you know, just, you know, regarding those three sisters that came out. I mean, that was just it was a nail biter situation where, you know, it went on for like 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks. Before, you know, all three of them agreed to be taken out, and every week the news just kept getting worse and worse and worse in their neighborhood, and so I really thank God for the outcome. But it was only possible because there were a small handful of Sudanese people that were willing to literally sacrifice themselves to help those women.
Well, I can't thank you enough, Brad. And I got to land this plane. Are there any more words, anything else you want to share with us before I'll let you know?
No, you know, we've had a wonderful response in the last month. And, you know, VPP has been a catalyst for that, for this work. I mean, when we saw that it was possible to do something, even to be involved in evacuations, you're one of the first people I talked to, because I had no funding, no hope that we could do, you know, anything. And so it's really been the support of the listeners of this podcast and the VPP that have been a catalyst for a lot of work and support that is coming from other directions unrelated to VPP. I mean, Voice of the Martyrs has been one of our champion of our work for many decades. And they're continuing to stand with us. Samaritan's Purse, as I said, is doing tremendous work there. We've had the chance to partnered with them in the past. And but VPP is really, really been a champion, and I'm so grateful for you and not only your friendship, but for your willingness to take on more on top of all the other stuff that you're doing. So,
well, I know what it's like to feel alone in a country that's falling apart, and I don't want you to have that feeling, and I want to be there with you as much as I can, and as much as our organization can, and our donors stepped up. I'm so grateful to every day. I say, I have the best tribe. I started this podcast to find my tribe. I think we're a strange tribe, Brad. This podcast, half our listeners are overseas. One of our donors, and he listens to the show, he lives in Syria. He's a Syrian Kurd. He gives $2 a month. Doesn't have running water. You know, his community was decimated by ISIS in the war. Insists on giving us two. We have people listening all over the world. The Uyghur diaspora, big listeners to the show. This is a very unique tribe, and a lot of the folks listening have experienced personally the same types of suffering the Nuba and the Sudanese are experiencing right now. And we've knit together a great tribe. My son, when he was with us, and it was great, my 16-year-old was with me in Washington, D.C. this past week, and he had a very interesting experience. He got to meet Pompeo with me, and he got to hang out with Seb Gorka. I did his TV show, and we went to a bakery and ate fresh bread and had coffee and Northern Virginia, right. And he hung out with, you know, of course, you know my son well, and we hung out with you and your team. And my son said to me, it was really something. We were in Washington, D.C. We were just walking around. He said, "Dad, how do you have friends like this? How are these people your friends? Your friends are just, I just don't understand. Like, how do you meet all these people?" And I said, "Son, if you strive to live at the foot of the cross, you will be surrounded by beautiful people. At the end of the day, the most selfish thing you can really do, if your goal is to just surround yourself with beautiful people, is to pray for the grace to live at the foot of the cross." And my 16-year-old son, who's a 16-year-old boy, right? He's a 16-year-old kid. But he noticed it. He said, "Dad, these people are all exceptional." And, you know, he had so much fun just hanging out with me and your team and some of our other friends. But I'm just so grateful for your friendship. I'm so grateful for your example. I'm so grateful for your humility, your quiet courage, and the work that you and all of your team do, because you're a good leader. And everyone at PPF reflects sort of your line of gesture, the mission of your organization. I can see it in all your team members. And so I'm just grateful. It's a privilege to stand for you. And by God's grace, we're going to meet this match. I don't know how for 18 months we've been able to meet all the demands that have been thrown on us, because it doesn't make sense. It's overwhelming. And I think I've been asking for money so much, pretty soon people are going to – they're just waiting for me to say, touch your iPhone 3. Or hopefully it's not iPhone 3. Touch your iPhone 9, 12, 13, and I will heal your canker sore. No, we're not going there. I'm not going to do that. But we have been asking a lot, and the reason why is because we've been asked by others for help, and I am not going to say no. And thanks to you, we've been able to deliver every time we've set out to help. And this is the biggest request we've done in a long time, to try to meet a $100,000 matching grant. TheGreatCampaign.org. Let's partner with the Persecution Project Foundation to serve the persecuted church in the Nuba Mountains, and their neighbors who aren't Christian, and their family members and loved ones who aren't Christian. But let's stand with the persecuted church in the Nuba Mountains, in Sudan, as they are suffering. They are nailed to the cross right now. They are nailed to the cross right now. And I know Brad has friends that I've met who literally have been nailed to the cross by extremists, literally nailed to a cross because of their faith. Well, these people are metaphorically nailed to a cross, and I want us to stand with them. So please go to thegreatcampaign.org and let's make that match. Brad, you get better. I'm trying to get better before my trip. I'm heading to Ukraine. You're heading back to Africa.
I'm heading back this weekend. And yeah, anyway, it's good to hear your voice. It was good to be with you. And like I said, I'm so grateful for BPP and for your friendship and your leadership.
All right, well,
let's keep going.
All right, thank you, brother. Drink some tea, and we'll catch up soon. I'm going to land a plane.
Okay, God bless.
All right, guys. And again, we've been asking a lot. I created this podcast to find you. That's why I created this podcast. Because I knew there was a tribe. There were people around the world who their teeth itched at the thought of children suffering. Their teeth itched at the thought of the persecuted church. Their teeth itched at the thought of communities facing genocide. And like a beaver chews wood to stop his teeth, their teeth from itching, we do what we can in our small way to stand and support strong people in impossible situations. That's what stops our teeth from itching. So when you hear of children being crushed and starving to death in neighborhoods that are being bombarded with artillery and cordoned off by divisions of soldiers with AK-47s, so they're starving to death, and all the adults have been killed, and they're there alone, starving and dying, and that makes your teeth itch, then go to thegreatcampaign.org and become a monthly donor. Become a donor to our match. And I really want to make sure that the Persecution Project Foundation can do all. They've been there for over 20 years, almost 30 years. He tells you 26 years he's been in the Nuba Mountains. And he has deep roots. So this is his family. Brad's lived there. This is his family. These are his friends, his best friends. So we want to make sure that our friend can stand with the persecuted church, who happens to be his close friends. And this show is being brought to you by the Vulnerable People Project, greatcampaign.org. Please support that work. This episode is also being brought to you by Epoch Times. Go to ireadepoch.com. Use the code Jason Jones, and your first month is only a dollar. Then I want to ask you for this. I'm going to Ukraine. I'm going to Kyiv. I'm going to a conference. As you know, Kyiv is under relentless rocket attacks. This doesn't have my family and my wife very happy that I'm doing this. She knows it's my job. She hasn't asked me not to. She has actually, this is your job. You have to do your job. But I'll just say you pray for the conference, for its success. It's a conference on human dignity, the value of human life in Kyiv next week. Pray for the conference. And pray for all the participants that they're safe. And pray for the people of Ukraine. Pray for the people of Russia. Pray for the people of Eastern Europe. It's a very sad place where our world is right now. And for those of you who read my first book, The Race to Save Our Century, that came out in 2014, that I started writing in 1996, where I lay out how the 21st century is going to unfold, sadly, We got it pretty much all right, John Smerick and I, and it breaks my heart. So why do I go to Sudan, or why will I go to, why am I going back to Ukraine? I'm going to promote the truth about the human person, where the truth about the human person is being undermined. I'm going to stand with the suffering while they suffer to give them hope. And then I hope that exemplifies to others how to order their lives. That's why we do what we do. And I want to thank you for listening to the Jason Jones Show. I want to thank you for sharing it. I think last week, again, we topped the top 100 podcasts in the United States, which is strange that a show like this, that I do it sporadically because we're so busy, and the shows can range from 40 minutes to 5 hours. It has an 80% completion rate. 80% of people listening finish every show. I want to thank you for that, and I want to thank you for helping the show grow, and we want it to grow because we want people to know about the suffering that the mainstream media doesn't find it useful to cover. They'll cover it for a fit. They'll cover it if it serves some powerful group's interests, but when the vulnerable are suffering, and they serve no useful purpose to powerful special interests, the mainstream media and the governments of the world look away, and they don't want you to pay attention either. And that's why the show exists, so that we look where they don't want us to look. We stand with the folks that they don't want us to stand with, and we speak out when the world wants us to shut up. All right? That's why we're here. I'm going to speak up When you want me to shut up, I'm going to speak up. All right. When the people that you tell me have leprosy, I have to go stand with them. I'm going to. Oh, they have leprosy. Great. Can I kiss them? Yeah, my Lord kissed people with leprosy, so will I. All right, guys. Well, sorry for the rambling conclusion. I'm going to do a few more shows before I leave, and I hope to do some shows in Ukraine. I'm going to try to do a show. I have this new equipment. I think I can maybe even record a podcast from the train. We're going to be moving to video, I think, later in the summer, and we have some big things planned. We've been getting a lot of media this week. We were in Daily Wire. I was on Seb Gorka's show last week. Rome Reports did a show on us this week. And I think I'll put all that in the show notes. And I'll probably be doing a show this week with our diplomatic liaison, Marilis Pinheiro. We can talk more about that. All right. Until next time, the Jason Jones Show. Aloha.
This has been the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media.